Welcome to Listen to Older Voices, a program produced for Uniting Melbourne and broadcast through the Community Radio Network. It's always a pleasure to bring you through their stories, life and times of older people in our community. All very interesting, all very different, and all very entertaining. Hello, I'm Rob Greaves, and welcome to Listen to Older Voices. This is the third and final part of the life and times of Hungarian-born Charles Palagyi, who, as we all learn, not only survived the war as a boy in Hungary, living later under Russian occupation, but with his family as refugees, found his way to Australia, experienced life in the Bonegella migrant camp in Victoria, almost became very rich as a teenager, but was forced by his father to go to university. Now, he's earned the right to be called Dr. Charles Palagyi, having gained his PhD and having had an amazing and diverse career as a molecular biologist. His life has not been dull in the least. Now, Charles is an adaptive man who moved from engineering to chemistry through physics to biophysics, biochemistry and into genetic engineering. His stories, both in Australia and overseas, involving these changes are very informative and most interesting, and are supplemented with stories involving his wife and his family. Now retired and living in a gated community in Mount Evelyn, Victoria, Charles shares his thoughts and his concerns on the consequences of the ageing process as it affects him and his wife. And it reminds us all that the issues he faces are the issues we'll all have to face one day. We pick up with Charles talking about how his father made him go to university, which was something that he did not want to do.
My sister, she would have been 4 years older, who desperately wanted to go to university, couldn't. She had to go and thread pearls in some dim-lit office in the city, but I had to go to university and I hated the very thought of it. Oh, so I was so disappointed.
Because you were on the threshold of possibly becoming a very rich man.
That man, as I recollect, didn't have family, and I think I would have even inherited the whole thing.
So instead you end up at university. Doing what?
Well, Sputnik went up in those days.
Of course.
I always had medical school at heart. I enrolled in medicine at Melbourne Uni, but I didn't even attend the first lecture because my mum, who had been a cleaner in the anatomy department, said, look, there are dead bodies in the anatomy department. You have to go down and cut samples off all these bodies, and some of the students even have their lunches down there. And that put me off, and I'm rather squeamish about blood in hospitals.
No.
So Sputnik went up at that time, and I thought, I'll become a rocket engineer.
Yes. Oh, fair call.
Because my father being an industrial chemist, I was interested in chemistry, and so I decided to do chemical engineering, and that's how I ended up in the science department. Chemical engineering didn't last long because I didn't like it all that much. After 2 years, I went into full-blown chemistry, which I enjoyed. And then for a PhD, I decided to accept a scholarship in Tasmania where my electrochemistry would come in handy because I studied the electricity of plants. Now, that was amazing to me. I never knew plants had electricity, so I got interested in biology. That's how I ended up in biophysics, physics and chemistry of living organisms.
Okay.
But when I saw what they were doing in the anatomy department at the University of Tasmania, where the professor of anatomy had a cat all strapped up, you know, with half his brain sucked out and electrodes stuck in. I thought, I couldn't do that. So I stuck to plants, which I thoroughly enjoyed. And that ended up to be my career.
How did that translate into a career? With whom?
Well, jobs were highly available in those early days.
Of course they were, yes.
I mean, not that there wasn't competition, but they were available because universities were expanding. New universities were being built. I got a PhD, and as soon as I got the PhD, CSIRO contacted me, two of their branches, and they fought over me.
Oh, how?
The CSIRO station in Deniliquin and the CSIRO in Canberra. And Canberra won out. He finally talked me into it, and apparently they had a fight, the two...
Goodness me. Oh, well.
Two departments, two divisions of CSIRO, and a fight over me. And that's how it was in those days.
Yes.
You know, you had a PhD, everybody wanted you. Mount Isa Mines took me out to dinners to convince me to become a chemist with them in Mount Isa. So it was a dream for graduates in those days. It's very different now.
So you and your wife moved up to Canberra?
We moved to Canberra. I worked for them for 4 years in the CSIRO. And my boss, who was actually the Prime Minister's scientific advisor, was made professor at the ANU, Australian National University. So he took the whole section with him to the ANU, and that's where I then worked for the next 3 years. And then one day I approached the boss and said, well, look, I'm on this research fellowship. How about giving me a permanent job? Because I was doing very well. And he said, well, look, to get a permanent job, you have to have overseas experience, because Australia had an inferiority complex in those days. Without having experience somewhere in America, Canada or England, it was very hard to get an academic job.
Oh,
so I said, look, I'll give you a good reference. You go to America, get some experience, and then apply back in Australia and you'll get a job. And that certainly worked. Because I got good references from America, good references from my previous boss, and I got a job at La Trobe University as a lectureship. Yes.
Right. How long were you there for?
I was there from 1971 till 2004 when I retired.
Okay. Oh, well, that's a fairly lengthy stay.
It was. It was home away from home.
Yes.
Again, because I'm not a studious person, I took it rather easy. I wasn't the model academic, but I managed to get along.
Well, you must have been there for that long, yes.
Yeah.
So the family had to move up to Canberra to work the CSIRO, then lock, stock and barrel to the States.
That's right, penniless. We sold everything to even get travel to
America.
So
you didn't have a grant or anything that paid your way over?
Well, in America, I got a scholarship there at Michigan State University for $10,000, which was okay, but because we arrived in penniless, we were struggling to make ends meet. And in America, everything depended on the dollar, and I think it still does.
Yeah.
And, of course, we're without any support from relatives.
Yes.
No family support on our own. The boss did help me a little bit, in particular when our children both got sick.
Oh, health insurance, of course.
Yes, health insurance is a big thing over there.
Expensive without it.
Yeah, and even today when you apply for a job in America, the first thing you look at is what sort of health insurance comes with the job.
Right.
But I was satisfied. I got health insurance, so we went over there. I collected all the bills because my daughter got severe asthma over there. Michigan is well known for bad respiratory issues.
Mm-hmm.
And after collecting all these bills, I thought one day, now I'll go to the office and make a claim. And the lady sorted all these bills and she ended up with one huge pile and another pile with only two receipts in it. And she gave me the big pile and said, we can't pay any of this because those were illnesses.
Hmm?
But we can pay these two because they were accidents.
Oh, no.
Turned out the university only gave me accident insurance.
Dear, dear.
So our few dollars were spent on medical bills. And I'll tell you how bad it was, especially in those days in 71. And I can tell you another story too about America today. I carried my daughter in the snow in the middle of the night to an emergency hospital, ended up in the waiting room where there was only one other family there with a very, very sick child that was crying. So when the door swung open, said next, I pointed towards the other family.
Of course.
And she said, no, no, I can't take them. They can't afford it.
Oh.
They have no insurance.
Oh.
It's the same today because I've got two friends in Seattle in the church there. One used to be a Marine, so he's got, insurance. The other guy used to be a insurance salesman. And because of the big financial crash, he had to give up paying premiums.
Mm.
Well, the friend without insurance has a very, very painful leg for which he needs morphine, which he can't get, he can't afford, to go to the doctor. His son-in-law said, well, Dad, all I can do for you is I can pay for 1 week's of morphine for you, and that's all I can do.
No.
Now, the other guy who severed his fingers slipping down from his roof while he was cleaning the gutters, he had extensive treatment, all free, absolutely free, because he used to be in the Marines.
And therefore his insurance was paid.
So insurance is very important over
it's
there.
It's certainly a country of divisions in all many ways, isn't it?
It is. And yet, Rob, when we talked to Americans in 71 about the wonderful hospital treatments we get in Australia, they said, so you're a communist country.
Oh, please.
We wouldn't want any of that.
Oh, please.
I'm sure they're regretting it now.
I bet they are.
Listen to Older Voices, where stories from the past find a home in the present.
I'm Rob Greaves and I'm talking with Charles Palagy. And Charles is talking about the amount of travel he's had to do in regard to his work.
So the family's been uprooted in the States and now you're being uprooted to go back to Australia and back to Melbourne to Latrobe.
Yeah.
It's a lot of travelling around. Did you do any travel for pleasure?
It was always work related.
Always work.
Travel for pleasure only happened once I got a payout from retirement.
Okay. Well, what did your wife and you, where did you travel?
Well, I travelled to a lot of international conferences.
Of course.
Then my boss decided to retrain me as a genetic engineer in 1989 because my electrochemistry on living plants, it no longer attracted interest. It just began coming old-fashioned.
Mm-hmm.
And so genetic engineering was the new bandwagon.
That's
so
right.
I said, look, we'll send you to England, to the best institute there, and you'll learn. And we'll pay for you. So I got an Australian salary, and we went to Norwich in East Anglia in England. And it was great there. We were there for 9 months. And so I took my family up, and that was really good experience. And that's where I learned molecular biology. How to genetically engineer plants. Once again, no animals.
No animals involved.
No.
And then back to Australia
back
again.
Back to Australia. We loved Norwich.
Yeah.
Everybody was friendly. The lab was first rate. And, it was a great experience.
Excellent. Yeah. Your life certainly hasn't been dull. That's one thing we can say. It's certainly involved a lot of change, hasn't it? Are you an adaptive person then, are you?
Well, I had to be because I changed from engineering to chemistry, to physics, to biophysics, then to biochemistry and genetic engineering. So I had to be adaptive to move with the times.
So how old were you when you eventually retired? Retired in terms of full-time paid work.
Oh, that's right. It's interesting. I was waiting to retire at the age of 65, but 4 months before retirement, the financial advisor said, Charles, you'd better retire 4 months early. You'll get a better payout deal if you retire early than at the age of 65.
Right.
And he said, the Senate is about to introduce a new bill and you'd better change before the new bill comes
in. That's right.
And it worked out that way.
Oh. Most people who aren't our age, that is seniors, tend to think about retirement as when everything stops. You retire, life stops, you stop. It hasn't stopped for you and it doesn't stop for most seniors, does it?
No, it doesn't. Most university academics, especially if they're on senior staff, they become members of boards and help the university in all sorts of executive positions as advisors. Well, my contribution was when I retired, because the department had already laid off so many people to save money. And that was another reason where God intervened 4 years earlier, Rob, if I can mention that. There was another academic in our department who was very, very successful. And one day the boss came to me and said, Charles, would you like to take a package?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, oh, I surrendered my super in 1986, so I'm really starting off on super again. I can't afford to retire. And he said, well, look, Charles, I've got to lay somebody off. But since you told me that you can't afford to retire, I think I'll get rid of the other guy. And that actually happened. So it was a great honour that even though I wasn't liked as a creationist in the department because I spoke out very vocally on against evolution theory, he said, we'd like to keep you and I'll get rid of the other guy. Now, I felt very privileged that he made me that offer because, honestly, I would have struggled to make ends meet when he made that offer. So I retired in 2004. By that time, my super had built up once again to a reasonable amount.
So what has retirement meant for you?
Well, when I retired, Rob, I was very sorry for the department because they were, their teaching commitments remained the staff. They now had two less people. So I decided to stick on for another year and virtually continue some of my lecture courses for almost free. I was paid a small sum, but since it's interrupted every day of my week, virtually I couldn't run my own whatever I desired during my retirement. So it kept me down for about a year, and then I decided to give that away. But I decided to at least help them out for 1 year, by which time they got things together and everything under control again.
Okay, but even today, you don't look like a man who would be happily just sitting gazing at his navel.
No,
you must be occupying yourself doing something.
Well, I decided, Rob, that now that I had all this free time, apart from a few cruises that we did, of course, now was the time for cruising.
well, it was earned.
Yeah. I decided to do voluntary work for the church. Mm-hmm, so I worked in the office and they were glad for another pair of hands. Mm-hmm. I was hoping to do something more important than that because I ended up scanning documents to put on the computer and filing documents. But because I was mingling with those sort of people, I picked up a lot. But I did that for quite a number of years. And I'm sort of still doing it. I'm running a seniors group for the church.
But what do you mean you're running a seniors group? What does that involve?
Well, what this means is that apart from the church having an official program, you know, on Sundays and sometimes during the week, they have these home fellowships where people can meet during the week, maybe once a fortnight or once a week, depending on which group you're in. And they cater for all sorts of groups. Some groups that want to do in-depth Bible studies, some groups that are designed for parents with young families where they get advice on Christian upbringing of children, or all sorts of home groups. And the one I'm running at the moment, I'm going to have my first meeting this afternoon, actually, is for seniors.
Okay.
So seniors who during the day feel they want a bit more Christian fellowship, where we can enjoy fellowship over a cup of tea and some biscuits or cheese. We get together once a week. I go to another Christian group for men only. But I wanted to form this Christian group which is for both sexes, you know, right. So families can come along,
yes,
husband and wife. Men's group is fine. You can discuss all sorts of things, sport and even war and that sort of thing, you know, anything that makes men happy. But I prefer more family orientation, so I decided to set up a seniors group, which they didn't have because the chaplain who did run it before decided to look after an old age home.
Right.
To so become chaplain there. And he moved on.
Yes. Now, you're in this rather, if I might put it this way, beautiful surroundings here. I mean, I'm looking out of your lounge room window at the hills that roll out past Hillsville, and it's quite a serene place.
Oh, we love it.
What is it about living in a well, it's almost like a gated community in some ways.
It is.
What's it like?
It's a very friendly community. It's Evelyn Ridge Retirement Village in Mount Evelyn. We were told in the beginning that it's not cheap. You're not buying an investment because you actually lose money moving into a retirement village. but you're buying a lifestyle. And that's what I thought would be great for my wife, who now has partial dementia, that we can go and join in all the community activities that they organise. They're very active. They've got a bowling green, a swimming pool. They organise all sorts of leisure and activity classes, you know.
Right.
So you can join in or you can remain private in your own house. Right. Nobody, or at least rarely, do they knock on your door and disturb you. So we don't disturb each other. We certainly give each other a phone call. Mm. Do you want to meet? Come over. It's great.
And you obviously feel safe here.
We are very safe. One day just recently, we went for a week to Lake's Entrance. When I came back, I realised I'd left the flywire door open and the door was wide open.
Oh, goodness me.
I hadn't locked up because I helped my wife to get into the car. We were so anxious to get going. I forgot to lock up.
Whoa.
And nothing was missing for a whole week. Imagine that.
You could not do that out in the outside world.
No.
No, you could not. Are there any disadvantages that you find living in a community like this?
Well, the disadvantage is that the village we're in is independent living, and it means that that you do have to look after yourself. We're a small village of only 150 people, so even though we've got a commercial kitchen, no meals are prepared there. We do get a caterer to come in, and we pay for meals now and then. We have a happy hour where we all bring snacks. The bar is open. That's graciously attended to by volunteers who stock it. But you have to be able to look after yourself.
So what about a medical emergency?
Medical emergency, we've got emergency buttons. I've got three in this house and a pendant for my wife. You can press the button and although there's nobody on site at weekends, the people answer within 1 minute, and if they don't get a response, they actually visit you in case you're unconscious or something. But when my wife had a stroke about 4 years ago and I was present, there's no way she would have even thought of pressing a button.
Of course not. Of course not.
Not even the one around her neck.
Yes.
Because she sort of became semi-conscious and delirious she lost her capacity for speech. And so people who have lost their partners, and one of them expressed it to me, they're fearful of becoming unconscious in their own unit and nobody finding them for days. And I know a case of one at another retirement village where she fell unconscious in the backyard, even though she had a pendant on. She couldn't press the button. She was there for 2 days before her son found her in the backyard.
Oh, goodness me.
Just lying out on the grass.
Right. So while it provides a lot, it doesn't provide everything.
That's right. So they have to have some kind of signal system if you've got a good neighbour, through the blinds, to make sure you get up every morning. Some of them ring each other, you know, okay, darl, and that sort of thing.
Mm.
But that's a constant worry. And then the worry is where to move to next. If you're incapable of driving.
Of course.
Suddenly bound to a house. There is a village bus that takes you shopping once a week. But I injured my elbow one day. My wife no longer has a driving license. And I thought, I can't drive the car this week. What will happen if this persists? Without a car, I'm totally lost here.
So is this an issue that you find you're having to think about more often these days?
I have. We've contacted aged care. We've put ourselves on the list for possible relocation to a nursing home should things deteriorate. Carer comes in. I get help once a fortnight, you know, cleaning up for 1 hour, and they give showers to my wife twice a week. But these things are now dwelling on my mind more and more because I've heard of cases here where they've, you know, people develop dementia very suddenly, all of a sudden, you know, and they have to find a place to live somewhere else, a nursing home.
Yes.
And some people find a good nursing home, others are less lucky.
Yes.
So it is on one's mind continuously as we continue to age.
So the ageing process is something that none of us can avoid, and in some ways we need to embrace it. But it does bring about its own issues and things that we have to deal with, whereas we would like to think as we got older we didn't have to deal with these things.
I know, it does. And so these are weighing on the minds of many residents who are approaching that age. In the meantime, though, Rob, I find that everybody here has a bucket list before they're in a wheelchair.
Good for them.
And they're travelling a lot. There's a lot of travel.
Yes, I think. Yes. Sadly, our time is almost up. And there's just one final question I would like to ask you, Charles, because your journey from that little boy in that Hungarian village all the way to a village here in Australia has been full of ups and downs and the most extraordinary events. If I said to you, has it been a good life, how would you answer that?
Well, Rob, it has been a mixed life. And looking back, I can see where God intervened many, many times to save my life. Both in war, in the army, doing national service. You wouldn't think that's dangerous, but it can be. And so I've written that all up on my website. I got so excited. That's why I spent a lot of my time lately writing up this website, because my kids said, why don't you write it all down? So I've been doing that. And when I look back, it's been a wonderful life.
Charles, there's no way we could have got your life in a few programs. But what we have had is a snapshot of events, snapshot of stories. And I just want to thank you very much for sharing them so openly with us on Listen to Older Voices.
And I really thank you, Rob, for taking the trouble to record this and coming to our place and inviting me to participate in your program. Been lovely.
Thank you, Charles.
Thank you.
Listen to Older Voices is produced by Rob Greaves at the Melbourne Community Support Program. Listen to Older Voices is supported by financial assistance from the Commonwealth Government through the Commonwealth Home Support Program and is brought to you through the Community Radio Network.